precious as higher knowledge is, if it is to come to us, we must not long for it. Moreover, if we wish it only for our own ends, we will never attain it. This requires, in the first place, that we be honest with ourselves in the depths of the soul. We can no longer have any illusions about ourselves. We must look our own mistakes, weaknesses, and shortcomings in the eye with inner truthfulness. Each time we find an excuse for a weakness, we place an obstacle before us on our upward path. Such obstacles can be removed only by becoming enlightened about ourselves. There is but one way to overcome failings and weaknesses, to see them for what they are, with inner truthfulness. All that lies dormant in the human soul can be awakened. Even intuition and reason can be improved if, calmly and detachedly, we become clear why we are weak in these areas. Such self-knowledge, of course, is difficult. The temptation to deceive oneself is enormous. But if we make a habit of being honest with ourselves, the doors to greater insight open for us. As esoteric students, we must let all curiosity vanish from us. As far as possible, we must lose the habit of asking questions simply to satisfy our own inquisitiveness. We must learn to ask only those questions that serve to perfect our being for the sake of evolution. Neither our delight in learning nor our devotion to it should in any way be diminished by this. On the contrary, we should listen with rapt attention to anything that serves this end and seek every opportunity to practice such devotion. Esoteric development requires, above all, the education of our life of wishes and aspirations. This does not mean that we should have no wishes or desires. If we are to attain something, we must first wish for it. And our wishes will always find fulfillment if a special kind of force lies behind them. This force or power arises from right knowledge. Do not aspire to something until you know what is right in a given domain. This is one of the golden rules for the student of esotericism. If we are wise, we will first learn to understand the laws of the world. Then our wishes will become forces able to realize themselves. The following is a clear example. Certainly many people wish to experience for themselves something of their life before birth. But such aspirations remain futile and pointless if spiritual scientific study has not given them insight into the most subtle and intimate details of the essential nature of what is eternal. If they have really achieved such insight and now want to proceed further in their understanding, then their aspiration, refined and purified, will help them to do so. It is no good saying, "I really want to know about my past life, and for this I will even study and practice." Rather, we must be ready to give up all such desires and must renounce them completely. We must learn to learn without ulterior motive. We must be able to rejoice in and be devoted to what we learn for its own sake. Only in this way can we have an aspiration that brings about its realization. Whenever I am angry or irritated, I build a wall around me in the soul world, and the forces that should develop the eyes of my soul cannot approach me. If, for example, someone annoys me, he or she sends a soul current into the soul world. But I cannot see this current as long as I am still capable of anger. My anger hides it from me. This is not to say that if I master my anger, I will immediately perceive such soul or astral phenomena. For that, I must first develop an inner eye for my soul. Each of us possesses such an eye in rudimentary form, but it remains ineffective so long as we are still capable of anger. Not that it appears as soon as we have begun to combat the anger in ourselves. Rather, we must continue on, struggling patiently with our anger, until one day we notice that this inner eye in the soul has opened. Anger is not the only obstacle to the perception of astral phenomena that we must struggle against. Many people become impatient or skeptical if, after having struggled for years to overcome certain traits, clairvoyant seeing still does not manifest. Such people have simply cultivated some qualities while allowing others to grow all the more unhindered. The gift of seeing arises only when we have suppressed all the traits hindering the emergence of the latent faculties corresponding to them. Admittedly, the beginnings of clairvoyance or clairaudience may appear earlier, but then they are like tender young shoots, vulnerable to all possible errors, and can easily die away if not carefully cultivated and tended. In addition to anger and irritation, we must also struggle against other traits, such as fearfulness, superstition, prejudice, vanity, ambition, curiosity, the urge to gossip, and the tendency to discriminate on the basis of such outer characteristics as social status, gender, race, and so on. We may have difficulty in understanding that the struggle against such traits has anything to do with increasing our cognitive abilities. Yet every occultist knows that much more depends on these things than on our ability to expand our intelligence and practice artificial exercises. Misunderstandings can easily arise if, for example, we believe that the injunction to overcome fear means becoming foolhardy, or that to fight against discrimination based on social status or race means becoming blind to the differences among people. The fact is that we learn to recognize these differences for what they are only when we are no longer caught up in prejudice. Even in ordinary life, fear of a thing prevents us from seeing it properly. In this sense, racial prejudice prevents us from seeing into a human soul. The esoteric student must take such ordinary common sense and perfect it inwardly with great sensitivity and precision. We place an obstacle in the path of our esoteric development whenever we say something without first having carefully refined and purified it in our thoughts. This can best be made clear by an example. If someone says something to me that I must respond to, I must make an effort to pay more attention to the other person's beliefs, feelings, and even prejudices than to anything I myself might add to the conversation at that moment. In other words, if one is on an occult path, one must dedicate oneself conscientiously to schooling an impeccable sense of tact or delicacy. We must learn to gauge the significance for another person of having his or her opinion contradicted by ours. This does not mean that we should hold back our opinions. There is no question of that, but we should listen to the other person as carefully as possible and formulate our response on the basis of what we have heard. Once again, it is a question of a single thought arising in us when we are in such situations. We know that we are on the right path when this thought lives within us so strongly that it becomes part of our character. This thought is, it does not matter if what I think differs from what the other person thinks. What matters is that, as a result of what I can contribute to the conversation, the other discovers what is right out of themselves. Permeating ourselves with thoughts of this kind seals our character and conduct with the mark of gentleness. Such gentleness is one of the main methods of esoteric schooling. Gentleness removes obstacles, opening our soul and spirit organs. But harshness, callousness, frightens away the soul forms that should awaken the eyes of the soul. As we develop gentleness, another trait begins to form in our souls: quiet attention to all the subtleties of the soul life surrounding us, together with the utter stillness of our own soul's activity. If we achieve this, then what is taking place in the soul life around us helps our own soul unfold and grow organically, just as sunlight helps plants to flourish. Thus, patient gentleness and stillness open the soul to the world of souls and our spirit to the country of spirits. Abide in calm, single-mindedness, and solitude. Close your senses to all that they brought you before you entered on the path of esoteric training. Bring all the thoughts that habitually ebbed and flowed within you to rest. Become perfectly still and inwardly silent, and wait patiently for higher worlds to fashion the eyes and ears of your soul. Do not expect to see and hear in the worlds of soul and spirit right away, for what you are doing now is merely a contribution to the training of your higher senses. Not until you have these senses will you be able to see with the eyes of the soul and hear with the ears of the spirit. Once you have been established for a while in calm and solitude, then go about your ordinary daily work. Have this thought deeply imprinted within you. One day, when I am ready for it, I shall receive what I am to receive. Therefore, do not be tempted to attract to yourself anything of the higher powers through sheer self-will. Such are the instructions that every esoteric student receives from his or her teacher at the beginning of the path. If we follow these instructions, we shall perfect ourselves. If we do not follow them, then all our efforts will be in vain. They are not hard to follow if we have patience and constancy. There are no other obstacles than those that we ourselves put in our way, and we can avoid these if we really want to. This must be emphasized repeatedly because many people have a quite false idea of the difficulties of the esoteric path. It is in a certain sense easier to take the first steps on this path than it is to cope with the most mundane problems of daily life without the help of esoteric training. Only such information is communicated in this book as poses no kind of danger to the health of the body or soul. There are, of course, other approaches that lead more quickly to the same goal. But such faster ways have nothing to do with the path presented here, because they have certain human consequences that are considered undesirable to anyone experienced in esoteric practices. Since bits of information about these other ways are at times made public, an explicit warning must be sounded against them. For reasons known only to an initiate, such practices can never be described openly and in their true form. The fragments that appear here and there cannot lead to anything positive, but will only undermine health, happiness, and peace of mind. If we do not wish to entrust ourselves to dark powers, whose true nature and origin we do not know, we shall do well to leave such other approaches alone. At this point, something may be said concerning the environment in which the exercises of our esoteric training should be practiced. This has a certain importance, yet it must be understood that the requirements vary from person to person. Someone practicing esoterically in an environment entirely pervaded by selfish interests, such as is found in the modern struggle for survival, should be aware that such interests affect the development of one's soul organs. The inner laws of these organs are, of course, strong enough to prevent such influences from causing real harm. A lily cannot turn into a thistle, no matter how inappropriate its surroundings. Nor can the eyes of the soul develop into something other than what they were intended to be, even when they are worked upon by the self-seeking interests of our modern cities. Nevertheless, whatever our circumstances, it is good to practice the exercises whenever possible in the quiet peacefulness, inner dignity, and charm of nature. The ideal situation would be to pursue our esoteric training among green plants and sunny mountains, surrounded by the loveliness of nature's simplicity. This would produce a harmony in our inner organs that would never be possible in modern cities. In other words, a person who has grown up surrounded by fragrant pines, snowy peaks, and the quiet bustle of forest animals and insects is better prepared for esoteric work than the person born in the city. Yet none of us, even if we must live in a city, should fail to nourish the organs developing in their soul and spirit with the inspired teachings of spiritual science. If we cannot see the forest turning green day by day each spring, we should at least nourish our hearts with the lofty teachings of the Bhagavad Gita, the Gospel of St. John, and Thomas A. Kempis, and with the findings of spiritual science. Many paths lead to the summit of insight, but it is essential to choose the right one. A person well-versed in esoteric practices can say much about these paths that may seem peculiar to the uninitiated. For example, we may have advanced quite far along the esoteric way. We may be standing, as it were, on the threshold where soul eyes and spirit ears open. Then we are lucky enough to take a trip across the ocean. Seeing the sea, calm or stormy, as the case may be, the scales fall from the eyes of the soul, and suddenly we are able to see we become seers. Another student, at a similar point in his or her development, may be hit by a hard stroke of fate that would paralyze the strength and undermine the energy of any ordinary person. Because the student is on the esoteric path, it becomes an opportunity for illumination. Again, we may persevere patiently for years without noticeable results. Then suddenly, as we sit in silent meditation in our room, we find ourselves surrounded by a spiritual light. The walls disappear and become transparent to the soul. A new world spreads out before our eyes, which now see, sounding forth for the ears of our spirit, which now hear. Chapter 5. Requirements for Esoteric Training. The requirements or conditions for entering into esoteric training were not arbitrarily devised by any human being. They arise naturally out of the nature of esoteric knowledge itself. Just as we cannot become painters if we are unwilling to handle a paintbrush, so we cannot receive esoteric training if we refuse to meet the conditions an esoteric teacher considers necessary. Strictly speaking, such teachers can give us only guidance. Whatever they say should be taken in this spirit. They have passed through the stages that prepare one for cognition of the higher worlds. They know from experience what is needed. But it depends entirely upon our own free will whether or not we choose to walk the same path as they followed. Were we to ask an esoteric teacher to allow us to enter esoteric training, but were unwilling to meet the conditions, it would be like saying to a painting teacher, "Teach me to paint, but please excuse me from having to touch a brush." A spiritual teacher has nothing to offer a student who does not, of his or her own free will, first come to meet the teacher. Yet, it is not enough simply to have a vague wish for higher knowledge. Many people have this wish, but this wish alone, without the willingness to meet the specific requirements of esoteric training, achieves nothing. All those who complain that following the path is not easy should remember this. If we cannot or do not want to meet such demanding conditions, we should simply give up the training for the time being. Certainly, these conditions are strict, yet they are not harsh, and carrying them out not only should be, but must be, a free deed. Without this fact of our own free choice, the requirements imposed by a spiritual teacher might easily seem coercive to our soul or conscience. Esoteric training has to do with the education of our inner life, and the spiritual teacher counsels us to this end. Nothing that flows from our own free decision can be called coercion. Were we to ask a teacher, "Tell me your secrets, but leave my ordinary habitual perceptions, feelings, and ideas untouched," we would be asking the impossible. With this attitude, we would be seeking to satisfy our own curiosity, our desire for information, and we would never attain esoteric wisdom. What follows is a description of the series of conditions to be met by the student. It should be noted that none of these requires complete perfection. We need only strive toward that goal. No one can fulfill these conditions completely, but everyone can set out on the path to their fulfillment. It is our attitude and our will to begin that are important. The first requirement is that we turn our attention to the improvement of our physical and mental or spiritual health. Our health does not in the first place depend on us, yet we can make an effort to improve it. Sound understanding, healthy cognition occurs only in a healthy human being. Esoteric schooling does not exclude unhealthy people, but it demands that they have the will to lead a healthy life. Such health depends upon achieving the greatest possible independence and autonomy. As a rule, the good advice that others give us, whether we want it or not, is quite unnecessary. We should strive to take care of ourselves. With regard to physical health, warding off harmful influences is more important than anything else. To fulfill our obligations, we often have to do things that are not conducive to our health. Indeed, in certain cases, we must learn to place responsibility above health. Yet, there is much that we can give up if only we have the goodwill to do so. Certainly, duty is often more important than health, and sometimes even than life itself. Gratification, however, should never be the first priority. For the student of the esoteric way, pleasure should be only a means to health and life. Here we must be completely honest and truthful with ourselves. It is no use leading an ascetic life if this arises out of the same motives of gratification as do other pleasures. Some people gain the same satisfaction from asceticism that others gain from tippling, and we cannot expect this kind of asceticism to be useful for higher knowledge. Many people blame everything that seems to hinder their spiritual progress on their outer circumstances. They claim that they cannot work on themselves in their present life situations. It may indeed be desirable to change our situation for other reasons, but we do not need to do so for our esoteric training. All we need to do for this is promote our bodily and mental health as much as we can, given our present circumstances. Whatever we do, even the smallest task can benefit the whole of humanity. It is a much greater act of soul to be clear about how necessary every small and even menial task is to the whole than to think, "This work is too low for me. I am called to something higher." Therefore, it is especially important for a student to strive for complete mental and spiritual health. An unhealthy inner life impedes our access to higher knowledge. Clear, calm thinking and reliable sensations and feelings are essential. Nothing should be further from us than any tendency toward fantasy, excitability, nervousness, inflation, and fanaticism. We must acquire a sound eye for all that life presents to us. We must learn to cope confidently with life. We must learn to allow things to speak to us quietly, letting them work upon us. We must make every effort to meet life's demands wherever and whenever necessary. We should avoid all exaggeration and one-sidedness in our judgments and feelings. If we cannot meet these conditions, we will not experience the higher worlds, but only the world of our own imagination. Instead of following the truth, we will be guided by our own opinions. It is better to be down to earth than inflated and full of fantasies. The second requirement is that we feel ourselves to be a part of the whole of life. Much is involved in fulfilling this condition, but each of us can approach it in our own way. For instance, if I am a school teacher and a pupil does not live up to my wishes, I should direct my feeling not at the pupil, but first at myself. I should feel myself so at one with my pupil that I can ask, "Is this pupil's shortcoming not perhaps my own fault?" Instead of blaming the pupil, I should rather reflect upon how I might change my own behavior and so help the pupil meet my expectations in the future. This kind of attitude will gradually change our whole way of thinking about the greatest as well as the least of things. For example, I will look upon criminals differently. I will now withhold my judgment and contemplate our common humanity, thinking, "I am a human being just as this person is. Perhaps it was only my upbringing, which my situation in life has given me, that spared me this fate." Then I will reflect that criminals, who are my brothers and sisters in humanity, might have turned out very differently had they received the attention and encouragement my mentors gave me. I will be led to reflect that I have received something that was withheld from them, that my good fortune comes at their expense. It is then but a small step to the insight that, as a member or organ of humanity as a whole, I am jointly responsible with all human beings for everything that happens. This insight should not, of course, be immediately translated into political agitation in the world. It should be calmly cultivated in the soul. By this means, it will gradually come to expression in my outer actions. Indeed, in such matters, we can begin only by reforming ourselves. To make general demands for social and political reform on the basis of such insights is fruitless. It is easy to say how other people should be, But students of esoteric knowledge must work in the depths and not on the surface. It would therefore be quite wrong to connect the demands of esoteric schooling with any external demand for reform or even political change. The education of the spirit has nothing to do with such things. Political activists generally know what to ask of other people, but they hardly ever talk about asking anything of themselves. The third requirement of esoteric training is intimately connected to the second. It requires that we win through to the conviction that thoughts and feelings are as important for the world as actions. We should recognize that when we hate our fellow human beings, it is just as destructive as when we physically strike them. This brings us once more to the insight that anything we do for our own improvement benefits not just ourselves, but also the world. The world benefits as much from pure feelings and thoughts as from good deeds. Indeed, as long as we do not believe in the world's significance of our inner lives, we are not ready to take up esoteric training. And we only rightly believe in the meaning of our inner lives, our souls, when we care for our souls and perform our inner work as if it were at least as real as our outer work. We must know that what we feel has as much impact upon the world as the work done by our hands. With this, the fourth requirement is already stated. We must acquire the conviction that our true nature does not lie without, but within. We can achieve nothing spiritually if we regard ourselves merely as a product, a result of the physical world. The very basis of esoteric training is feeling that we are soul spiritual beings. Once we have made this feeling our own, we are ready to distinguish between our inner sense of duty and outer success. We learn to recognize that there is no necessary and immediate correlation between these. As esoteric students, we must find the middle ground between following the demands of the world and doing what we see as the right thing to do. We must not force upon others something that they cannot understand, but at the same time we must be free of the urge to do only what those around us recognize and approve of. Only the inner voice of the soul, as it honestly strives for higher knowledge, can confirm our truths. Yet we must also learn as much as possible about our environment and find out what is useful and good for it. And if we do so, we will develop within ourselves what esoteric science calls the spiritual scales, or the balance, on one of whose trays lies a helpful heart, open to the needs of the world, and on the other, inner firmness and unshakable endurance. This brings us to the fifth requirement, steadfastness in following through on the resolution once it has been made. Nothing should lead us to abandon something we have decided upon except the insight that we have made a mistake. Each resolution we make is a force that works in its own way, even when it is not immediately successful in the area where it is first applied. Success is crucial only when we act out of longing. But any action motivated by craving is worthless from the point of view of the higher world. In the higher world, love is the only motivation for action. As esoteric students, all that stirs us to action must be subsumed in love. If we act out of love, we shall never tire of transforming our resolutions into deeds, no matter how often we may have failed in the past. As a result, we do not judge a deed on the basis of its outer effect on other people, but take satisfaction in the act itself of carrying out our actions. We must learn to offer up our deeds, our very essence, to the world, regardless of how our offering may be received. To be esoteric students, we must be prepared for this life of sacrifice and service. The sixth requirement is that we develop the feeling of gratitude for all that we receive. We should know that our very existence is a gift from the whole universe. How much is necessary for human beings to receive and sustain their existence? We owe so much to nature and to other people. Grateful thoughts such as these must become second nature for those engaged in esoteric training. If we do not give ourselves fully to such thoughts, we shall never develop the all-embracing love we need to attain higher knowledge. Only if I love something can it reveal itself to me. And every revelation should fill me with thankfulness, for I am made richer by it. All the above conditions come together in the seventh. Always to understand life as these conditions demand. In so doing, we create the possibility of giving our lives the stamp of unity. All the different expressions of our life will then be in harmony and not contradict each other. And this will prepare us for the calm, inner peace we must develop during the first steps in esoteric training. If we are sincerely and genuinely willing to meet these requirements, then we are in a position to commit ourselves to esoteric training. We are then ready to follow the advice given in this teaching. Some people may find many of these suggestions too outward, too related to external life. Perhaps they did not expect the course of esoteric training to unfold in such strict forms. But everything in our inner life must develop through something outward. Just as a painting that is still only in the painter's head cannot be said really to exist, so esoteric training cannot be said to exist if there is no outward expression of it. Once we know that the outer must express the inner, we can no longer hold the strict forms in low regard. It is true that the spirit is more important than the form, which indeed is nothing at all without the spirit. But the spirit would remain idle if it did not create a form for itself. These requirements are intended to make us strong enough to fulfill the further demands that spiritual training inevitably imposes. If we lack the proper foundation that meeting these conditions provides, we will face each new challenge with misgivings. We will not have the belief in people necessary for esoteric work. To believe in and love humanity is the basis for all striving for the truth. Our striving must be built upon trust and love for humanity, although it does not begin there. Rather, it must flow out of the soul's own forces. And this love for humanity must gradually expand into love for all beings, and indeed for all existence. If we are successful in this, we shall have a deep love for all that is constructive and creative. Our natural inclination will be to avoid all destructiveness. As esoteric students, we must never destroy for the sake of destroying, neither in deeds nor in thoughts, words, or feelings. Growth and development must be our joy. We should lend our hand to destruction only if we are able to bring new life out of what we destroy. This does not mean that we should stand idly by while wickedness prevails. On the contrary, in every evil we must seek out the elements that allow us to transform it into good. We will then see more and more clearly that the best way to combat wickedness and imperfection is to create what is good and whole. We cannot create something out of nothing, but we can transform what is incomplete into something more perfect. The more we strengthen our creative tendencies, the sooner we will find ourselves capable of the right attitude toward whatever is bad and imperfect. Anyone who enters esoteric training must realize that its purpose is to build up, not tear down. Therefore, we should bring to it a desire to work sincerely and devotedly, not to criticize and destroy. We should become capable of reverence, because we are to learn things we do not yet know. We should look reverently toward what opens before us. Work and reverence are the fundamental attitudes expected of us as esoteric students. When we experience a lack of progress in our training, despite what we consider our unceasing efforts, it is because we have not fully and properly understood the meaning of work and reverence. Work undertaken for the sake of results is the least likely to produce them, and learning unaccompanied by reverence is unlikely to advance us far. Love for the work, not for the results, alone moves us forward. And if we strive for healthy thinking and sound judgment, we will not blunt our reverence with doubt and distrust. Simply listening to what others say with reverence and devotion rather than immediately opposing it with our own opinions, need not lead to our becoming slavishly dependent upon them. Those who have achieved something on the path to knowledge know that they owe everything to patient listening and assimilation, not to their own obstinate personal opinions. We must always remember that where we have already formed a conclusion, we cannot learn anything. If we desire only to judge, therefore, we can learn nothing. Esoteric training, however, depends on learning. As esoteric students, our willingness to learn should be unconditional. It is far better to withhold our judgment on something that we do not understand than to condemn it. We can leave understanding until later. The more levels of cognition we attain, the more we need to be able to listen attentively, calmly, and reverently. For the work of cognizing the truth, indeed, all activity and life in the world of the spirit, is infinitely more subtle and delicate than what we do in the course of our ordinary life and thinking in the physical world. The further our horizon expands, the subtler the work we must perform. That is why there are so many differing views and perspectives concerning the higher realms. In reality, of course, there is only one view of the higher truths. We can reach this view if, by work and reverence, we have risen to the stage of actually beholding the truth. Only if we are insufficiently prepared and form opinions on the basis of our favorite ideas and habitual thoughts will our view differ from the only true one. Just as there cannot be different opinions regarding a mathematical theorem, so there cannot be different views about things in the higher worlds. But in order to arrive at such a view, we must prepare ourselves. If we bear this in mind, we will not be surprised by the conditions required by a spiritual teacher. Certainly, truth and the higher life dwell within the human soul, where each one of us can and must find them. But they lie deep within, and can only be brought up from the depths after the obstacles have been cleared away. Only a person experienced in esoteric science can advise us on how this is to be done. Spiritual science offers this advice, but it does not force truths on anyone and does not proclaim any dogma. It shows a way. Each of us could find his or her way on their own, but perhaps only after reincarnating many times. Esoteric methods shorten the path. They allow us to reach the point where we can collaborate in the worlds where spiritual work advances the human evolution and salvation. This concludes all that may be said for the moment about the attainment of experiences of higher worlds. The next chapter will continue these observations by showing what happens in the supersensible members of our being, in the soul organism or astral body, and in the spirit or thought body during higher development. Thereby, what we have said so far will be seen in a new light and explored more thoroughly. Chapter 6. Some Effects of Initiation. One of the basic principles of true esoteric science is that those who dedicate themselves to it must do so in full consciousness. As students, we should undertake nothing, nor engage in any exercises whose effects we do not understand. An esoteric teacher, when giving advice or instruction, will always explain what the effects of following the instructions will be on the body, soul, or spirit of the person striving for higher knowledge. The present chapter will describe some of the effects of the inner work upon the soul of the esoteric student. Not until we are aware of these effects can we practice the exercises that lead to knowledge of the supersensible worlds in full consciousness. Indeed, only the presence of such full consciousness allows us to be called true students of this path. Authentic spiritual training forbids any groping in the dark. Those who do not wish to carry out their training with open eyes may become mediums, but they will never become seers or clairvoyants, as esoteric science uses these terms. Those who practice the exercises described in the previous chapters will, first of all, experience certain changes in their so-called soul organism. Only a seer can perceive this organism, which may be compared to a more or less soul-spiritually luminous cloud whose center is the physical body. All our instincts, desires, passions, ideas, and so on are spiritually visible within this cloud. For example, sensual desires are perceived in the form of dark red rays radiating in a certain form, while pure and noble thoughts express themselves in radiating red-purple hues. Sharply defined concepts, such as grasped by a logical thinker, are felt as yellowish forms with quite distinct outlines. But the muddled thoughts of confused minds appear indistinct. Intolerant and opinionated thoughts appear sharp, fixed, and inflexible, while thoughts open to the concerns of others appear flexible and changing, and so on. The further we advance in soul development, the more regularly structured our soul organism becomes. This organism remains confused and unstructured in a person whose soul life is still undeveloped. Yet even in such an unstructured soul organism, a clairvoyant can still see a form that stands out clearly from its surroundings. The form extends from the inside of the head to the middle of the physical body. To the clairvoyant, it looks like an independent body containing certain organs. These organs, which we shall now consider, may be seen spiritually in the following areas of the physical body. The first, between the eyes. The second, near the larynx. The third, in the region of the heart. The fourth, in the neighborhood of the pit of the stomach or solar plexus. And the fifth and the sixth in the lower abdomen and reproductive region. Because they resemble wheels or flowers, esotericists call these formations chakras, wheels, or lotus flowers. But these expressions are no more accurate than calling the parts of a building wings. In both cases, we are dealing only with figures of speech, with analogies. In a person whose soul life is undeveloped, the lotus flowers are of a darkish color, quiet and unmoving. In a seer, on the other hand, they are in motion, shining forth in different colors. With some differences, the same occurs in the case of mediums, but this does not concern us here. One of the first things to occur when an esoteric student begins practicing the exercises is that the light of the lotus flowers intensifies. Later, the flowers will also begin to rotate. When this happens, it means that a person is beginning to have the ability to see clairvoyantly. These flowers are the sense organs of the soul. Their rotation indicates that we are able to perceive the supersensible realm. Until we've developed the astral senses in this way, we cannot see anything supersensible.